Welcome to Conversations for a Brave New World with Donna, Sonia and Cliff, where we bring you a global, national and local focus on gender, sexuality and feminism.
Welcome to another episode of Conversations for a Brave New World. This week, we talk about LGBT experiences and what's really going on in LGBT health and well-being in Australia. A lot of different statistics suggest that roughly 1 in 10 Australians are lesbian, gay or bisexual. And depending on the numbers you look at, approximately 4.5 to 5% are trans or intersex. Despite being a relatively significant part of Australian population, LGBT people still report worse mental health outcomes compared to the general population. For instance, LGBT people are nearly 6 times more likely to report depression and are more than 3 times as likely to report having an anxiety-related condition. About 30.3% of LGBT people aged 18 and over reported having attempted suicide at least at one point in their life. So in this episode, I'm joined by Natalie Amos and Shakara Little-O'Hunt from Arches in La Trobe. Natalie and Shakara recently co-authored Rainbow Realities report, bringing together health and well-being data on the LGBT communities in Australia. And they're here to share with us some of the insights that have come from their research. Natalie, Shakara, do you mind telling me a little bit about yourselves, what got you interested in this topic, and then we'll get into Rainbow Realities?
So my name is Shakara Little-O'Hunt. I'm a proud Wadjuri and a proud bisexual. I'm a PhD student, actually, at the University of Western Australia, and I'd worked at the Charles on Kids Institute as a research assistant for a couple of years before that, predominantly in the area of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander LGBTQIA+ mental health and social emotional well-being. So I was really lucky to be invited to be part of the Rainbow Realities report, based off some work that we've been doing together looking at some of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander queer data. Really excited to be here today.
Thanks, Shakara, and welcome to the show. Really excited to get the Indigenous perspective because that's often a voice that we don't hear about in the LGBT space. And Natalie, what about yourself?
Hi, I'm a research fellow with the Australian Research Centre for Sex, Health and Society at La Trobe University, or at shorthand we call it ARCHES. I manage the knowledge translation and analyses of our two largest surveys of LGBTQA plus people to date in Australia. We have an adult survey and a young people survey, and they cover a really broad range of health and wellbeing topics. So I've been with ARCHES for the last 3.5 years and in a really lucky position where I got to come in with all this data having been collected and just delve into the data and produce papers and outcomes from this. It's a really wonderful space to work in. There's, you know, huge strides happening in LGBTQ space, but also a long way to go.
Definitely. And that's so true. I mean, we often think about the start of LGBT rights in Australia in 1978, but it goes back way beyond that. And yet we are still on that journey in some ways to gaining that acceptance and understanding how prejudice operates based on sexual orientation, gender identities, and then you add in everything else like disability, ethnicity. I suppose, Shak, from your perspective, like being LGBT and First Nations or Aboriginal, what's the complexity there? What are you learning from your research around that?
What I have learned is that there is, I want to say, a massive amount of complexity, but it's kind of decentering what is the queer experience and why is it always framed as being a white queer experience. And so I've been really lucky in doing this that we've been able to have a lot of conversations with community and with elders around just thinking through what it actually means to be a queer and Aboriginal person and how that works in our culture and with our understanding of traditional knowledges. But also then understanding this intersection between homophobia and transphobia and racism, and the massive impact that can have on young people's well-being, which is really the part that I'm focused on. And I think there's not clear answers. Obviously, I'm a researcher and trying to pull that apart. It is a really, really mixed bag, I think. And what we found in the Rainbow Realities report is some pretty upsetting findings. In terms of people's mental health and experiences of discrimination. But there's also a huge amount of strength, and that is something that I really want to highlight always, that in some of the other work that I'm doing, huge amounts of acceptance from, like, Aboriginal elders who are, you know, 80 and 90-year-olds who are just so willing to come to the table and talk about this because they're so motivated to accept their young people. What we saw in the Rainbow Realities report was some really lovely findings around what makes people feel good about themselves, actually being able to feel a sense of self-efficacy and self-mastery in their connections with other people and being able to express themselves, and what that can mean as someone who is both First Nations and queer.
Absolutely. And I just want to talk to you about what you mentioned earlier, the notion of how queerness has been constructed as white. I've seen that in my own research where, you know, we think about queer spaces and there is this perception that they're typically white and you're not welcome in there almost. How does that play out being a First Nations person?
It's not quite as straightforward as I was expecting, I think, when we were going into doing the research. Some of the findings that we talk about in the report and in some of the other work I've done point to the fact that, yes, a lot of people have experienced racism within the queer community. And, you know, those are spaces that we really want to be safe and supportive for people that aren't necessarily so. But also one of the things that we looked at was how that then relates to people's social and emotional well-being. And it wasn't having the impact that I was kind of expecting, compared to other experiences of discrimination. And certainly when you just speak to people, it's really mixed in terms of whether they are just fully welcome and accepted within LGBT spaces, or at least feel that that is like a good enough space for them, or if it's really not. So I think there's always, always room to talk about how we can decolonize queer spaces and how we can make sure that they're going to be welcoming and accepting for everyone. Because what we also saw was that there's a huge overlap between people who are Aboriginal and queer and disabled or have a chronic illness. I don't think it's an entirely bad story. It's just not a good enough story at this point.
Absolutely. And I think that's a very good thing to keep in mind that, you know, yes, we are still getting there, but there are also many amazing things happening. I think, Natalie, jumping over to you, could you tell us a little bit about what are you noticing coming out of the Rainbow Realities report? What are the great things? What are the things where we need to do better?
Yeah, so the report, I mean, it's more than 200 pages long. It has something like 52 new analyses reported in it across six different surveys from around Australia. So there is a lot of information in this report. The idea of it was to sort of bring together what we know about LGBTQ communities around the country into one epic report. And it does, I mean, we see what we expect. We see really big disparities in health outcomes for LGBTQ people and high rates of mental health concerns and suicidality across the community. But we do also see, as Jack said too, there's really beautiful evidence of the resilience of the community and in different ways. And we see sort of the positive or factors that can kind of positively influence or affect mental health outcomes and protect those mental health outcomes. So, for example, we see very, very clearly there's a few analyses in the report that show the importance of affirming young people in their identities, whether that's an affirming school environment, an affirming work environment where they feel safe to identify and express their identities in those environments, such as wearing clothes that feel right for them or using the appropriate bathroom. But we also see the importance of supporting young trans people to affirm their gender identity in ways that are meaningful to them. It's important to note that young people have different journeys in their gender affirmation. They might not want all the same. They might not have the same gender affirmation goals. But it is really important to support them in whatever those goals are. There's also some qualitative research in there. So there were open-ended questions in one of our surveys that asked young people what makes them feel good about themselves or what makes them feel affirmed in their gender. And a lot of the comments that came across was being given the space to really explore their identities. And many had that space. They had a safe space to be able to explore their identities, and they spoke about how important that was for them. So I think that there is those really beautiful positive stories coming out of it. And also community connection came up in a really beautiful way, particularly for people with disability. We see that LGBTQ people with disability, when they have connection to or feel support from communities within like disability, peers with disability or LGBTQ communities, they have better well-being and mental health outcomes, which was really cool to see. I mean, it's something that we kind of feels like a no-brainer, but it's nice to see in the data as well showing it.
Absolutely. And Natalie, I just want to touch on that topic which you just mentioned, because you're talking about how, you know, it's about providing students with that support for their own goals. And some of my research in schools, what we realized was there was this notion that we've got a gender neutral facility, so everyone who is LGBT has to use that regardless of whether they want to or not. And there can be sometimes that perception of, you know, one size fits all, but that's so true, right? We're all on this unique journey of discovering ourselves and all the messiness that goes with it and all the amazing things that goes with it. And there is really no one size fits all approach.
Yeah, absolutely. It's absolutely what we see. We see different desires for different forms of gender affirmation, whether it's legal, whether it's social, whether it's different forms of medical affirmation that people desire. And across the spectrum of all genders, what those goals are. And they, you know, some of the young people, I like the term messy because they speak about the messiness of exploring their identities, but in a really beautiful, positive, everyone's so diverse kind of way, which is also, I mean, it's something that I love working with the LGBTQ data and with LGBTQ communities, is that real celebration of everyone's diversity and supporting that however someone feels about themselves.
Absolutely. And messy is not a bad thing. I think messy is the exciting part about discovering yourself in a way.
Yes.
Chuck, from your perspective, this idea of messiness, discovering your identity, how does that play out within the First Nations, you know, for the First Nations queer communities? Are there differences? Because we all know how closely knit, you know, First Nations communities can be. And coming from a culture that's also quite closely knit and collectivistic, there are some amazing supports that come from it. There are sometimes some challenges that come from it too. What are you seeing in that perspective?
Of course, it's completely messy. And I don't want to oversimplify. One of the things we talk about a lot in Aboriginal research is that we are a very diverse group of people. We have a lot of different cultures, a lot of different experiences. And so I guess the idea of what an Aboriginal queer experience is that obviously it's going to be a lot of different things. And like with before, there is no one size fits all. And I think that in itself can be a difficult thing to navigate of, am I doing this the right way?
Can I ask a really silly question, Shaq? And I hope I'm not going to be offensive with this, but I'm trying to wrap my mind around it too. You know, coming from India, where I grew up, there is this whole perception that homosexuality never existed in India, although if you look at the religious texts from 3,000 years ago, they were, right? And it was this westernized import. How does that operate within the Aboriginal cultural context? Is there that disassociation between the word homosexuality and gay and lesbian as we use it now? Does that present a challenge? How is it seen within the communities?
Once again, it is really mixed, and depending on like which mob you're talking to, there might be a really different idea of what the history is there. Like with a lot of colonized countries, there obviously has been a huge impact that's happened with colonization, with religious missionaries, and what is a very painful history there. So depending on who you speak to, you can get a really wide range of answers between no, that never happened before, that's definitely a white thing, that's not our way. And yeah, of course we have queer people and we've always been here for queer people and there's a lot of room for that. And so I don't think there's one answer around, you know, were we here before? I think probably the conversation has moved to a place of it's going to be really hard to know. There's been so much damage to our oral histories and to the historical record that we kind of have to be in a place of, well, are we going to choose to accept people going forward in the future? I think it's Maddie Day, who's another queer Aboriginal scholar, who speaks about the idea that we don't actually have to existed in history in order to exist in the present and the future.
I think that's
That's kind of the place that we've come to is, well, what are we doing now?
That is such a cool idea, and I can see the application of it beyond just Aboriginal communities, because in my own life and culture, like, you know, I often hear, oh, but, you know, the gays didn't exist in the 70s. No, we were there. You know, especially coming from India, my parents don't know anyone who is part of the queer communities. For them, I'm the first person they know of, well, openly at least. And that to them creates this whole idea that, you know, they've never existed. We've never been there. We've never been a part of our story. And it's a new modern development in some way, like technology, I suppose. So, Natalie, from your perspective, what's shifting? How are we, you know, what's getting better? And where are we going as a queer community, as a collection of queer communities, I suppose?
So definitely there's a long way to go. I think that's not so much that queer community has a long way to go, that's the rest of society has a long way to go to be more supportive and affirming of queer community. But we do, particularly, and I love young people and I love their responses to our surveys. And you see this, even just seeing the diversity in identities and the language when we give open text responses for being able to self-identify with an identity that's not listed that they can't select from, and just the diversity in language that's used to understand their identity, as I think shows how we have increasing visibility and we have increasing representation of queer people, that young people are able to be given this space to be able to explore a bit more than they used to be able to. And I think for me, my positive take from that is that we're heading in a direction where this all sort of diversity will be able to be explored and accepted and supported and affirmed. I mean, we're still a long way to go. but I feel like we're heading in that sort of direction. And more, I mean, this report was commissioned by the Australian government to inform their 10-year national action plan for LGBTQ health and wellbeing, which is a really important step that the government is making towards supporting LGBTQ communities around the country. So I think that's probably a positive sign too. And hopefully that work and the research in this space will continue to improve experiences for LGBTQ people.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I feel like we, hopefully in our lifetime, we'll see that shift happen where it's more normalized than, you know, than from the time when I was born, I suppose. And, you know, Natalie, I think we're talking about this change. So what needs to happen? How can we, I don't know if the word speed it up is better, because it dumbs down, it ignores a lot of the complexity under it. But how can we speed it up? Because one of the things I keep hearing, which gets me, is, well, it's 2024. Aren't we already there? So what needs to happen to get us there?
I mean, sadly, we're not already there, and we see that in the data. What needs to happen to get us there? Education, training of health professionals, of support, people working in mental health care and support services, education for young people as well, for everyone, about what it is to be queer and the diversity within the community, understanding intersectionality as well and different intersecting identities and how that impacts people. I think education is key here, and teaching people kindness and affirming everyone in their identities. Just be kind.
That's not a hard idea at all, right? Like, just be nice, people. Shaq, what about from your perspective with the First Nations communities? Like, what needs to be done to support First Nations queer people being their fabulous selves?
I think one of the things that came out really strongly from the report was a real need for equitable and inclusive healthcare, which we know that not only do you have to go into services and maybe be dealing with homophobic and transphobic practitioners, but then the risk that you're also going to be dealing with racism or just care that is not culturally informed and not culturally appropriate. So I think that's a massive area for change. And I think there is a huge amount of movement and a lot of particularly queer services and Aboriginal community controlled organisations that are really keen to be supporting intersectional work. So that's been really great to see. I think some of the other things that come out pretty strongly is then finding ways to facilitate queer inclusive, like, community and cultural connections, and how we can do that in a way to make people safe and feel supported in, we talk about social emotional wellbeing in Aboriginal health as kind of a more holistic concept that includes what we kind of traditionally Western think about as being health, but also cultural connections and connection to country and spirituality. So I think viewing it from that lens, which again ties into the healthcare and being able to support through that. And the final kind of really interesting thing was actually talking about media representation, which there isn't a lot of, was actually significantly associated or correlated with well-being. And so I think where we can be promoting that, that would be a really solid win.
And that idea of media representation is really interesting, because I was just having a conversation about it last night where we don't really see gay men in a healthy relationship in media, in TV shows and in movies. We tend to see the comical gay person, we tend to see everything about the flamboyance, the sexuality, the sexualization, but we don't really see those serious roles and the serious relationships. And I don't know, a large part of my life is really boring. It's not flamboyant or sexualized. I think looking to the future, what advice would you all have for young queer people coming out? And Natalie, reflecting on the outcomes of the Rainbow Realities report, especially the young people in there, if you were talking to young people in rural regional communities, which can often be conservative, what would you say to them?
I mean, we do see the importance of community connection, and I think seeking out those connections, seeking out people that are supportive and affirming of your identity. It's harder as well. There's less of that accessible in rural and regional areas, and we see that too. There is some data in the report too about young people in different residential locations. So I think that connection is harder. There's more having to travel to inner city where there are more sort of queer spaces and queer events. But even being able to reach out online, I think there's more online stuff since COVID. Finding those safe and affirming spaces.
Absolutely. And just to build on what you're saying, I think one of the things that I found with my work is a lot of young people have a perception that rural regional communities are dangerous, so they don't even go out to start looking. And I think, hearing a lot of the positive stuff that's happening, which is what we're also seeing at the moment, there are groups, there are places that you can go. It just takes a matter of searching and finding them. And knowing that you'll always be welcome there, at least in the the groups that I'm familiar with, there is a support network available.
And interestingly, we see in the adult sample that living in rural and regional areas isn't actually as bad. So for adults, it's more out of suburban areas that are the outcomes are a little bit worse than it is regional and rural. And I think that might be to do with choice of where they're living. So adults who are living regional or rural areas are potentially choosing the towns that they're living in that are potentially more supportive towns or more inclusive, whereas young people are, they're living where their parents are living, not necessarily having chosen that space. So it is definitely not all bad in regional and rural areas, but it might depend on where you live and as you say, seeking out those spaces.
Absolutely. And Shaq, from your perspective, what would you like young Aboriginal people listening to this show to take away, about being queer, about, being queer in rural regional communities?
I kind of agree with Nat's point of seek out other people and connections, because we are there, and we are there if you look. I think it was kind of going back to the media representation point, Writing Themselves In, which is a study of young people that asked about, like, real or fictional people that you look up to who are queer role models, and the answer to that were pretty interesting. There weren't a lot of people of color or Indigenous people at all spoken about, but like I know they exist because as an adult I very actively looked for that.
Absolutely. And I think, just building on what you're saying there, Shaq, I think we've all been there and we've all been lonely and we've all found community, and it's fine to be feeling lonely, it's fine to be going through that experience. But it's also, great to be able to reach out after that, because loneliness is part of finding out who you are. And reality is we're still a minority. So, there is a sense of loneliness that comes from being that. But there is a fabulous community that's there willing to have you and embrace you and support you along that journey. Thank you so much for joining me today, Nat and Shaq. It's been so fabulous hearing your different perspectives and rainbow realities. And personally, I just hope, you know, in our lifetimes, we end up in a world where being queer is just like having red hair or any other defining characteristic.
Yes, I agree. Thank you, Cliff. Thanks for having us on.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
So now I'm joined by my co-host, Associate Professor Sonia Murray. Sonia, what do you think about that interview? What stuck out to you?
I guess the biggest thing for me, Cliff, was the fact that intersectionality really plays a role here, that we have this dynamic of being First Nations and also being, you know, part of the community. And I think that that is really something that we failed to take into account with a lot of our research. And it's only probably in the last 5 years that we're looking at intersectionality and how complicated it can make things.
Definitely. I think it adds another layer to consider, because no longer are we just talking about LGBT identities from a colonized, colonial, westernized perspective, but embedding the dynamic of what does it mean to be First Nations and have a cultural background like First Nations people do, and also the history of stigma and challenge that First Nations people have experienced in Australia, along with then being what it is like being stigmatized as an LGBT person. So that definitely does stick out in terms of having that complex impact on health and well-being. One of the things that I really like, though, is this notion that things are getting better.
I thought the same thing, actually. And I think as we unpack it more, we can really start looking at things from a strength-based approach too, which instead of a place of negative research, we start looking at the things that are working and start looking through that perspective.
And I think that's a challenge with a lot of research on minoritized groups, because there is this perspective about reiterating the trauma and the stigma instead of trying to find solutions. And, you know, I love what Shakara said, that Aboriginal First Nations elders are beginning to acknowledge diverse sexual orientations. They're interested in knowing more. They're interested in accepting and welcoming LGBT members of their communities. And it's just beautiful, because it shows you that prejudice is not a fixed thing. It can change. It, you know, it leaves you with a sense of hope in many ways. Hopefully in another 5 years' time, when we check in with another episode, things might be quite likely very different. So thank you for joining us here today on Conversations for a Brave New World. We look forward to you joining us again next month, same time, same place.
Thank you for listening. This show is brought to you by the Gender Network. To get involved or find out more, simply Google the Gender Network at Charles Sturt.